Here he is.
Hello, Joe.
Evening, gents. All right.
How are you, sir?
Yeah, I'm fine, thank you. Yourself?
Yeah, not too bad, not too bad.
Good.
Joe, that's the one with glasses.
Yeah, so I guess that.
Listen, mate, obviously, we'll just go through bits we have.
Yeah, of course.
Obviously, before we get on, just obviously tell us a little bit about yourself, about obviously your football first, and then obviously, you know, what happened to yourself a year ago, or just under a year or so ago?
Yeah, started my coaching / managerial career at Kent Football United, believe it or not. Stayed there for roughly 3 months with Sam McNeil in the early days when they'd just gone into the league. I think they were 2 years into the league or something. Really enjoyed my time there. And then the Cray Valley job become available, the coach's job. The coaches left there, and I remember coming home one night after a game at Kent Football, and the old man said to me that Cray Valley coaching job's available. I know Chapo well. I know Mark Edwards down there. He said, would you like me to give him a call and see if they'll have an interview with you? And that's when really I started to get majorly into it, if I'm honest with you. That was my first real coaching journey. I went down for the interview, sat there with Chapo and Mark, and we had a good chat, and I told them how I like to coach, how I like to play, and it all fitted in. And that was where I started, really, to be honest with you. That was my main sort of coaching role, first role in the now Skeffel League, but I think it was the Kent League back then.
And then obviously, you know, you went through, and I think you was at Sporting Club Thamesmead, wasn't you?
Yeah, so when I was at Cray Valley, I spent 2 seasons at Cray, and then my dad was offered the Earith and Belvedere job, if you remember. After Mickey Collins went up, he left the club, and John phoned my dad, and that was a hard decision to leave Cray, but I didn't think that I'd have the opportunity to work at that level with my dad, if I'm honest with you, again. So I took that with both hands, and we had a really good side down there, Keith, to be honest with you, and we were doing really well. We were flying. I think we was in the top 8 in the league at the time, and then for whatever reason, things didn't work out, and my dad ended up being told that his services weren't no longer required there, and soon after, they offered me to stay on, because he offered me to stay on, and I sort of said, no, mate, I'm not going to do it. I'm going to stay loyal to the old man, and I went with him. And then I didn't touch football for probably a year and a half. It was only when really my friends asked me if I wanted to take a under-18 job that I went back into it, to be honest with you. I was going to stay out of it. I was concentrating on my coaching company. That was going really well at the time. It was growing. And it was only when I got introduced to these young sort of, they were under 16s at the time when I took them on, first year in under-18 football. And they reminded me of our side, Keith, if I'm honest with you, our under-18 side we had at Thamesmead. They were just a great bunch of lads, powerful, strong, could pass the ball. And yeah, I thought this would be a nice little project for the next couple of years. So that's what I've done.
We're just going back, obviously, you know, tell us how strange was it sort of, or how did it feel working with your dad? Because obviously, you know, we're going to talk about your dad in a little while, but, you know, I've known you since you was a little kid, and you watched your dad manage every single game. You went everywhere with your dad as a young boy until you grew up.
Yeah.
And obviously, you know, all of a sudden, you know, you become a sort of a man yourself, and all of a sudden now you're in the dugout with your dad. How did that feel?
It was really good, to be honest with you. It was really enjoyable. I loved every minute of it. I mean, as you said, I was with the old man, Keith, from 4 years old up until whatever, 16, going to watch matches with him and stuff. You know what I mean? And I was in the dugout. I was in the changing room at times, probably being a pest to the players half my life. You know what I mean? But I loved every minute working with him. I learned a lot, to be honest with you, from him. Obviously, like you said, I learned rights and wrongs from him, more wrongs than probably rights. And it worked well because he was as he was, you know what he was like, Keith. And I was a sort of a calmer one and a bit more tactical, but he knew how to get players going. He just had that, he had that thing about him where players just listened to him when they were in the changing room. And I think that's quite a rare thing, but he seemed to get some players that, what he done well was he got players that weren't doing so well at other clubs and brought them into him, and seemed to give them that motivation and that belief to play. And he built dressing rooms, as you know. I mean, even recently with all the lads that have been coming around and stuff, and they all say the same thing. The dressing rooms that he built was unbelievable. And that's something that I learned from him. I learned that you've got to have a good dressing room and you've got to have a good team camaraderie to achieve things. You know what I mean? And that was always key with what he wanted to plan. And yeah, he was quite successful at it. So it was brilliant working with him, mate. It was a short while at Erith and Belvedere, and then obviously I got to work with him at Erith Town again for a season and a half, and we had a really good time, mate. Yeah, really enjoyed it.
How bad was it for your mum, though? Because obviously I know what your dad was like when you lost, but to have two of his in the ass on a Saturday evening or whatever when you lose must have been horrific.
Happened on a few occasions, mate. Yeah, we always said in the car on the way home, me and the old man, we was like, look, we've got to get home. Can't talk about football in front of mum. We've been away all day, blah, blah, blah. But you can't help it. You know what it's like, Keith. You're from a football, you've got a football background, and you just talk football, didn't you? That's all we done. It was all we done all night. How could we plan for the next game? Who should we play in the next game? And it probably drove her mad, to be honest with you, at times. But looking back now, mate, those are times that I'm going to cherish. You know what I mean? So I wouldn't have it any other way.
No, that's good. Well, obviously, let's just go back to, obviously, you know, the last 2 years now, Joe, which is, it couldn't have been any more horrific, I think. And I don't think you could script it. But just before, obviously, you know, you got ill, you was at Sporting Club Thamesmead, wouldn't you? And obviously, your own coach business was doing well. So just sort of lead us into to what happened.
Yeah, so like I said to you, I took the this under-18 side on. They were at Cray Valley originally, and then me and my dad got the Erith Town job, so we took that. And then we obviously we managed the under-18 side alongside Erith Town, if I'm honest with you, because they had some good players in the under-18 side that we used in the Kent League. Ben Mandele being one of them, Anthony Adesit being another, Max Williams, and they were all playing regularly, really, for Erith Town in and out the side, so it worked really well. And then obviously the under-18s went on to be really successful. They won everything there was to win, which was great. After we left Erith Town, me and Dad, Albert wanted to go his own way with Genco, which was fair enough at the end of the season. And he explained that to us. And obviously we went our way. We looked back that we'd done a good job there. We saved them from relegation the first year we went in. And then the second year we finished mid-table quite comfortably and had a good run in the cups and stuff and brought some really good youngsters through. So me and my dad were quite disappointed that he didn't really give us another year. I felt that if we had another year at that, we could have cracked it and done some more damage, to be honest with you. But and then after that, it was my friend, really. It was Aaron Jeffrey and Ben Williams and Jamie Williams. We were all sitting down in a pub one day, and Ben said to me, you know, Lee Hill's going to be leaving at the end of the year, Sporting Club Thamesmead. And I sort of said to him, oh, that's an interesting one. And I went and watched them play. I spoke to Sam, the chairman, and Lee. I was really interested and really impressed by the setup there for such a, obviously, you know, Keith, you've been there for years, you know what I mean? And I won't go into too much detail. It's probably a sore subject, but obviously I was really impressed with them and the ambition that they had. I had a good chat and decided that would be a nice little role for me to take. The old man didn't want to get back into it. I did say to him, do you want to come in with me? He said no. And he just come and watched all the games in the end. And started managing them. Really, really enjoyed it. I had a lot of my under-18s that were with me at Long Lane and brought a lot of them into the side, as well as a few others, Cameron Reardon and some players like that were excellent for me. And we had a really good young side, mate. We battled against it. We beat Beckenham Town. We went away to Sheppey and we beat them in the cup, got to the semi-final of the Kent Senior Trophy, I think it was. We had a really, really good season. And it was just a shame I didn't get to complete it, because I think that we could have probably finished in the top five or six that year and it would have been a really good season. But as you know, in March time 2019, I fell ill.
So just tell us, obviously, you know, about you. Firstly, obviously, people that don't know, how old was you then, Joe?
I was 26.
26. So yeah. Obviously, you know, tell us a little more about you and how it started and go through what actually happened.
26. I'm lying, Keith. I was 28, mate. Sorry, mate. I'm lying about my age.
Don't worry about that, mate. We all do it. Yeah. Women do it more than blokes.
So basically, mate, what happened was around March, I feel a little bit tired. I was saying to my family and my friends and that, I just said, look, just feeling a little bit tired, think I need to have a few days off work. And just didn't feel myself, if I'm honest with you. And then it was only really after a coaching session on a Thursday night. I was working for my company and come over a little bit funny at the coaching session. Nothing to worry about. Just felt a bit lightheaded and stuff. Anyway, I got home, drove home, and we was meant to have another coaching session that evening. And I remember ringing Max, who was working for me at the time, Max Williams, and I said to him, I can't come in tonight, mate. I just don't feel right. And he said, all right, no worries, I'll take the session. So I dropped all the equipment to him, went home. I think I went to bed, mate, if I'm honest with you. Just woke up the next morning with really bad belly pains and feeling sick. And yeah, I felt like I was going to faint. And I said to my parents that were in at the time, my mum and my dad, I said, like, I don't feel well. I need an ambulance, which was weird for me because when we look back on it now, all the doctors said you knew there was something. There was obviously something wrong with you for you to come out with that you need an ambulance. And obviously that was the day that I fell ill. That was the 29th of March, 2019.
So obviously, you know, you said you fell ill. So just again, I want you to elaborate so people get a rough idea. So talk us through step by step. Obviously, what happened? Yeah.
So basically, I got up in the morning, felt ill, said to my mum that I needed to call an ambulance. At first, you know, mum was like, look, I think you're over-exaggerating a little bit. Go and take a couple of Nurofen, get yourself back to bed, you'll be fine. My dad shut up the chemist, actually got me some Dialyte, thought I might have been dehydrated, took them on board, went back to bed literally for about 15, 20 minutes and shouted down again, said, like, I really don't feel well. And it was my sister come in my room and I called an ambulance and told them. They said to me that it was a 2-hour wait because my symptoms weren't anything of concern. And then my sister come into my room. I booked the ambulance. My sister come in about 5 minutes later and she said, no, you don't look good. I'm going to take you to the hospital. She took me to Queen Mary's. I went to the emergency department there, walked through the reception, spoke to the lady again, told her my symptoms. Went down to sit down. I was asked to wait. I think a few people that I was sitting down with realised that I weren't in a good way. By this time, there were like little purple blotches and stuff coming up on my skin that I didn't know at the time, but it was only when people sort of told me about that. And I was then called into the room. I sat down with the doctor. He took one look at me. And then the next thing I remember is waking up on a hospital bed inside Queen Mary's with about 20 people around me, literally having all sorts of things told to me and stay calm, breathe and all this. And I was blue lighted there from there to the Pru in Orpington. And then in the ambulance journey, I collapsed there and I woke up 3.5 weeks later from an induced coma that they had to put me into to save my life.
So obviously, you know, and for the people that you woke up and thought, well, you know, what's going on? But yeah, in that three and a half weeks, you know, like I said, I went to see your dad and I met your mum. What were they told in that time?
So basically, when I arrived at the Pru, the first thing that they needed to do was to get as much antibiotics into my system as possible. Someone at the Pru diagnosed it as sepsis. And obviously the key was to get antibiotics. But there were so many stories my mum and dad were told. My mum and dad were told that I had leukemia at one point, which was misdiagnosed. And they were told that I had a 10% chance to make it through and that they should start preparing for the worst. That's what they were told. So I don't know how any sort of parent or family would deal with that information. I'm sure it was just all a bit overwhelming at the time from nothing, literally from nothing, being fit and healthy the day before, feeling a little bit groggy, but everyone does every now and again. And then being told a day later that your son's got a 10% chance of making it. It was just a huge shock, I think, for everyone, mate. I think you'll know yourself. It was just that everyone I knew just went into a bit of a meltdown, really, and couldn't believe it had happened. And that's what they were told. I'd have a 10% chance to live, and they should start preparing for my funeral.
And obviously, for any parent at such a young age, when you're feeling fine, you just don't know. So obviously, you know, you managed to get through. You proved everyone wrong and the sepsis. But what happened when you woke up?
I woke up in King's, funnily enough. They moved me from the Pru to King's, and I woke up in King's. Really, mum, dad and sister were by my bedside when I woke up, which was nice. And I think it was just a case, really, of them trying to explain to me what had happened and what my body had gone through. I mean, sure, like many people, I didn't know what sepsis was. I didn't have a clue about it, never heard of it before. this happened to me. I thought it was something that you normally got from a cut or something like that, or a blood infection. Didn't think it was something that you could commonly just get through from nothing. And still to this day, the doctors are absolutely bemused about why I've got it. They still can't tell me how I got it or why I got it. There's a lot of people that are working on it and a lot of people that have got their opinions, but they can't. But yeah, going back to what you said, I woke up in Kings, had my parents by my bedside, and they all were sort of just telling me what had happened, really, Keith. And I was in complete shock. Couldn't believe it. Could not believe it. But they did say to me that when I woke up that I've been one of the lucky ones, and I was gonna make it through unscathed. That's what I was told at first by everyone around me, the doctors included. Sort of said, you're gonna make it through. Yeah, you're gonna have a few scars. And obviously, I was black and blue, as you can imagine. My skin had gone a little bit necrotic from all the antibiotics that were pumped into my system. So I had really damaged tissue on my feet, on my hands, on my face at the time, on my nose. But it wasn't anything that they were concerned about when I first woke up.
How'd you deal with that as a 20-odd-year-old, Joe? What's going through your mind?
First thing that went through my mind, to be honest with you, was about my coaching company. I know that might seem a mad thing to say, but you know yourself, Keith, you run your own business, and it's one of those things that sometimes without yourself involved, it can fall flat. And that was my first concern. How long am I going to be out for? And is it going to affect JMF? Because there's a lot of kids that we coach, over 1,000 kids a week. And I was more worried about them being affected by it, to be honest with you. And I sort of said that straight away when I woke up, what's happening with my coaching company? I said that to mum and dad, and they were like, don't worry, it's all taken care of. And luckily enough, there was a lot of people that that come to help me with that. And but yeah, that was my main concern. And then obviously the second thoughts are, am I going to be okay? What's the long-term damage of this? What can happen? And obviously at the time, it wasn't anything but positive. You're going to make it through. You're going to be all right. But yeah, unfortunately, later down the line, as I'll tell you in a bit, it just things seem to deteriorate for me, which was a shame.
So like I said, you know, and I met your mum and dad, and obviously Lauren as well. Yep. You know, that I know your mum, they never left your bedside every single day, did they? They were there as parents are, but you know, mentally was unbelievable, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, my dad took it quite hard, Keith, if I'm honest with you. No. With it. I think there was a few occasions that he broke down, but my mum had her moments, but she was a rock all the way through, my mum. Absolute rock by my bedside 24/7 when I needed her. And she was unbelievable. Obviously, Lauren as well. She's only young. To see her brother go through something like that wouldn't have been nice. And she was strong. She was strong as an ox. And the three of them come together, and they really, really got me through them initial few weeks where obviously you're scared and you don't know what's going to happen, and you're in a new environment. And they got me through them initial weeks until obviously all my friends and people could start to visit. And that's when obviously I spoke about it before, the football community coming together for me was just something I'll never forget.
Yeah. So obviously, you know, you've come through and you're being told a lot of positives, and you're hoping, and you're just thinking, you're mostly just laying there thinking, right, okay, as most of us, hospital sunk me out, I'm just going to walk out of here as I come in.
That was it. Yeah, literally. The doctors and nurses kept telling me, they just said that you've been lucky. You're gonna make it out of here, and you're pretty much unscathed, to be honest with you. One of the nurses did mention to me, and this is when all the story started, really. She said to me, you have got a couple of toes on your foot that have gone necrotic because of the amount of antibiotics that we've put into your system. And the worst case scenario, really, at this stage, is that you might have to have one or two toes amputated. And I remember at the time I was joking about wearing flip-flops and stuff on holiday. That's the kind of spirit that I was in with it. You know what I mean? It wasn't too much of a concern after everything I'd been through and been told that I was lucky to make it out at the other side. So that wasn't a really big concern to me. But it was only further down the line that I started to hear the nurses and started to hear my mum talking to the nurses and things about my foot. My left foot was getting better, but my right one just, it didn't seem to be improving. And that's when it got a little bit of a concern, and I start, you sort of get the vibe from the doctors and stuff that are looking at it. They can't help it. It's just their facial expressions and things like that. But I started to get the vibe that there's something a little bit more serious going on here than what I'm being led to believe. And the tissue viability nurse, Viv, come out and saw me. And again, she was really positive and said that you'll be okay. And that sort of made me think, oh, that's a relief. But yeah, I mean, it just didn't get any better compared to the left one. And a few weeks down the line, they said to me that I was going to have an operation to debride the foot, which basically means take all of the dead skin off and see what's left. And I knew at that point that this was going to be a lot more serious than what we thought. And yeah, I went down to that operation that day. And I remember saying to the surgeon as I went in, I got rolled in and I said to the surgeon, are you going to be able to save my foot? And he went to me, do you want me to be honest with you? And I said, yeah. And he said, I'm going to do the very best I can, but it's going to be a difficult job. And I knew from that point onwards that this was going to be a problem.
And what's going through your mind mentally, Joe?
Everything. Coaching. Am I going to be able to manage again? Am I going to be able to get out on the coaching pitch with the kids? Am I going to be able to work? Am I going to be able to earn an income? All that sort of stuff goes into your head, as well as am I going to be able to socialise? I didn't want to be in a wheelchair for the rest of my life. That's automatically the first thing that comes into your head. You go from being 1 minute being fully independent to realising that you're going to have to be independent on everyone else. Because at this stage as well, Keith, I had no feeling from my neck downwards as well. So obviously all my nerves and stuff had gone completely. So I was literally in a hospital bed, laying there being told this news, and I couldn't do anything about it. So many things flash through your head. But the main ones were obviously, am I going to be able to go back to work? That was the main sort of aim I have. You know me, Keith, I love my coaching. I'm fully involved in it and I coach every session that I can. And that was the scary thought that I might not be able to get back out there and do that.
I'm glad you mentioned that. Obviously you missed a big pit art and you just got it, but that you didn't have any feeling from your neck down. No. Because see, when I come, well, even other people, like, you had to be fed, didn't you? You basically could only move your lips and everything. You couldn't have your hands. You had to basically transform your whole body again, didn't you?
Yeah, so basically the nerves in my body died. So I had to, through the antibiotics and everything that were pumped into my system. So literally, the only thing I could move with my lips, I couldn't talk at the time. I had to have a tracheostomy to talk again, where they taught me to talk again. I had a little windmill in my mouth that used to go round and in my neck that used to go round, and I could talk for 5 minutes, then 10 minutes, and then build it up each day. So that was to talk. And then the feeling in my arms slowly started to come back, although it took a while. But at this point, I couldn't move my head off the pillow, as you know. And I was basically paralyzed from the neck down, to be honest with you. So everyone had to do everything for me. I had to be fed. I had to be turned on the bed so I didn't get sores. I had to be washed. And as a bloke, Keith, as well, it wasn't nice. You know what I mean? You don't like people doing all that for you, and I wanted to be independent, and I hated every minute of that. That was probably the toughest bit, having to have everyone do everything for me. As much as a luxury as that probably sounds to a lot of people, it was horrible being having to sit there and get everyone do everything.
Obviously, I know you well, and we're going to keep bouncing back and forward. Obviously, just with your dad there, obviously, I remember, you know, I come and visit you when you was in intensive care and you was out. And you said about your dad, and he come up to me and burst into tears. But you couldn't communicate, and like you said, you were, well, and Lauren, but a mate. You know, your dad loved his football, but you were major in part of his life, and you know that more than anyone. And obviously, I don't want to sort of upset you with that. But no. how was you know, just tell them what sort of your dad was like, a communication for you, wasn't he? It hit him massively, but he was, you know, massive for you, wasn't he?
Yeah, huge influence when I was in hospital. He, as you know, he communicated with everyone else on my behalf for me, basically, while I was there via Facebook. And he let everyone know my updates every day, whether it was the fact that I'd winked or moved my lip or anything big or small. He was letting everyone know, which was great, because obviously all my friends didn't know what happened, Keith. I just went off the radar, as you can imagine. They didn't hear from me for 2-3 weeks. It was only obviously the ones close to me that realised what happened. So there was a lot of people that didn't know. So he let everyone know for me. And I think in a way it was his coping mechanism as well. I think it helped him to cope a little bit better, because he was struggling, as you know. He was really emotional with it. He went out with a few of my mates a couple of times and broke down. And I think that's how he coped in the end, by just letting people know what was going on day to day with me, hour to hour, to be honest with you.
So obviously, we bounce back to yourself again. So you're having this problem with obviously your foot, and they've done this operation. Take us on again, Joe.
So basically, I went down for the surgery on my foot, and they debrided the foot, took all the way dead skin, And I remember waking up in the room where obviously everyone wakes up after their operation, and I was being given pain relief and all that. But although I was out of it, I could hear the nurses that were looking at my foot at the end of the bed talking, and I knew that what they were saying wasn't positive. I could tell it from what they were saying. I could just make it out. It's just one of them weird things that I sort of just got the gist that it weren't right. And I remember them bandaging it up, and I went up to my room, and I remember they said to me that there's a lady called Dr. Rose that's going to come and see you. She's a plastic surgeon, and she's going to come and explain what the next steps are. And that night, my mum was with me all that day, and that night I went to sleep. And for some reason, I woke up in the middle of the night screaming, and probably a concoction of all the drugs that I was on and everything like that. But I had a premonition that it was going to be bad. And all of a sudden, doctors started saying, cutting out, I'm going to cut my leg off, they're going to take my leg, they're going to do this, they're going to do that. So it was a weird one. And then my mum had to come up in the middle of that night to calm me down, and they give me another drug to calm me down, and I fell asleep. And the next morning I woke up, Dr. Rose come and saw me. She walked in, and lovely woman. She explained that the operation had revealed that there was not enough tissue to basically make the foot reconstructable. My other foot would be fine, which was good news. She did say to me that she started off actually the conversation by saying, look, I can save your foot. And I looked at my mum and I went like sigh of relief. And then she said, but, and when she said that, but, I knew that it was going to be bad news. And that's when she come out with the fact that it was just too far gone for it to be salvageable, to walk on again. And if she saved it, it would be more the fact that it would just be there to look at rather than use, which for me was devastating, as you can imagine, burst into tears. And it was from that point, then I realized that I was looking at an amputation. And then she come out with it and said, your second option is to have an amputation. And if you have that, you'll be walking again within 3 months. And when she said that to me, it was horrible, obviously. But at the same time, in the back of my head, I just knew that I had to basically grip my teeth. And that was the news that I was dealt, unfortunately, on that day.
How long did it take you to make your decision, Joe, just for people that...
Well, there was a friend of mine, actually, a funny story. A friend of mine, Liam McGarry, come to visit me on the day that I was told the news. He didn't know. He lived in Bournemouth. He was at university, and he drove down to come and see me. And for those that don't know, Liam, the year before, had a bad accident, an unfortunate accident, and damaged his back. And he was paralysed from the waist down. And it just seems weird that he come and see me that day. He chose that day to come and see me, because there I was sitting in that hospital bed being told that I was going to have my leg amputated. But if all goes well, you'll be able to walk again. And there was him sitting there that weren't ever going to have that opportunity again. He was paralysed from the waist down. So that was a huge help. That was a really huge help. I sat and spoke to him for an hour or two on my own without my mum and dad and that there. And he come out with a phrase, and he just said to me, look, he said, I would take what you've been given, the blow you've been given, over what I've been dealt 7 days a week. And when he said that to me, it just made me think a little bit, like, yeah, you're right, you're right, mate. Like, I can still do this. I can still get out and about. I'll still be on my feet. It's not the end of the world. Whereas for him, I know it's still not the end of the world. He's still gets about, but he's in a wheelchair permanently. You know what I mean? And I was being given that chance again to walk, which he couldn't have. And that inspired me to make the decision a lot quicker. I would say it probably took me two days to make the decision, mould it over. But yeah, it was quite a quick decision in the end, Keith. I was in hospital at that point for about probably 3 months. So I was just looking to get out as quick as I could, if I'm honest with you. I just wanted to do everything within my power to get out as quick as possible.
So obviously you made a decision, and
made the decision. They booked me in for my operation in July. So I was moved from King's to St Thomas's. They give me the all my injections to put me asleep. Went down for the operation. They worked on me for 9.5 hours. Then I woke up in the recovery room with no leg. So obviously that was quite shocking. I remember it was they propped it up at the time. They propped obviously what was left of my leg up at the time. And it was weird looking down at the sheets and seeing your whole leg there on your other side and then seeing that bit missing. And that's when it hit me, and I broke down a little bit after in the recovery room. And I did get upset, and obviously that's when it really hit me that this has happened, and my life as I knew it weren't ever going to be the same again. As much as I can get back to normal, and I will, it weren't ever going to be the same again.
Joe, I mean, listening to that, listening to where you're up to so far, just it's absolutely incredible. But I mean, was you actually told, you know, when you had to go down for the operation, sort of how much of the leg they were going to take away?
They said to me that it was going to be a below knee amputation. And then they said that obviously they, what they do is they work up the leg, and then they will take away what they need to, still leaving as much as possible for them to work with, in order for me to obviously have an active lifestyle after it. I mean, I know it's a mad thing to say. Obviously, I got my leg amputated. It's not lucky, but I was lucky in a way that I didn't have a above knee amputation, because that's a whole different ball game in terms of your rehab and getting back to normal and getting back to work. Because then you're looking at a prosthetic limb that needs to bend and things like that. So yeah, I was even though I was dealt this blow, I come out a bit lucky in the fact that I didn't have to have a above knee amputation and it was below. But yeah, when I compare my two legs together. It's not too much that they've taken off. It's around the shin area, really, that it comes to an end.
So, you know, I know it's easy for you to say you're lucky, and people who are watching this thinking bloody hell. Mm. But, you know, you did have to rewalk it. You know, you haven't just had to rewalk again. You've had to use your arms, your fingers, talk, yeah. Get up, build, then have your leg cut off, and then start again.
Yeah, basically, because then your body's in recovery mode. Obviously, you're tired every day. Your body's getting used to this big operation that you've just had. And yeah, it did take me a while to get back to myself before, like I was before the operation, if I'm honest with you. But yeah, I mean, the nurses and the doctors and the physios were just different level, Keith, if I'm honest with you. I mean, I'll never forget the day after my operation. I remember the physio bouncing in and saying to me, right, up you get, you've got to attempt some sit-ups. And I'm sitting there thinking, what, I've just had my leg cut off, right? And he's like, no, you get working straight away. And they did. They were like that. And they were in 2-3 times a day working with me. If I couldn't move because I was tired, they were stretching me, or they were moving my body for me, moving my knee joints. They were getting me back moving again. And yeah, the work didn't stop. It was full on until I obviously eventually went to the rehab center. But there was a little lapse that I had. So I come out of the operation. I was probably about a week into recovery, week or two into recovery, and started to get a few pains around the chest area. Told the doctors, reported it. They said it's nothing to worry about. It might just be stress, blah, blah, blah. And it just got worse and worse and worse. And I remember feeling a little bit like I felt before I got ill. But the pain was really bad. And it was, my mum was with me at the time, and she went and got a nurse. And by the time they both come back into the room, there was me again, unconscious. And I remember everything exactly as it happened before when I fell out of consciousness. I mean, they say that your life flashes before your eyes before you go. And I can tell you now, I know it might seem a bit far-fetched, but it does. All the images come flashing through your head when you go into a state of shock. And before I know it, I was being rushed down to ICU. I'd caught pneumonia on the ward. And I was back down to ICU after my leg operation, fighting for my life again. And luckily enough, the doctors worked their magic again and got me to come back round. But my mum again was told when she was in that room that it was going to be touch and go again. So yeah, not for a first time, but for a second time. So God knows what she was feeling at that point.
I mean, you've gone through this, and what you've gone through is unbelievable. But your family, to have 3, 4, 5 things happen to you, you know, and you're the kid. It's unbelievable. Like I said, I know the support you got has been unbelievable out in the football community, and I know you know that, and it's carried on. But how do you cope as a family?
They were just so strong, mate. Again, I go back to my mum. I can't speak highly enough of her, really. She was just so strong through the whole thing. A lot of people, it would have probably crushed. You know what I mean? But they just seem to get stronger and stronger. The worse and worse I got, they seem to get stronger and stronger. And I think they knew deep down that I'd got through the worst of it. And obviously, if I could have got through that, I can get through all the little bits and pieces that come with it. So they were positive all the way through. But listen, they have their moments, Keith. Dave, they had their moments. They were sitting there and, you know what I mean, at times burst out crying. I remember my dad come and see me on my hospital bed once after me op, just after I fell with pneumonia, actually. And he come and see me, and he just couldn't believe it. He just sat down and said, I just can't believe this has happened to you. But listen, they were strong for me. We're lucky really in the fact that we are a little bit strong around these sorts of things, and that's obviously got us through, obviously, especially the last 3 months with Dad. So yeah, quite blessed really.
Obviously, you know, we'll skip a little bit. You get home, you come home, and you have to rebuild your life. Then what happens?
So yeah, come up. I was at the rehab center. Got to the rehab center in September. Come out of the rehab center. Worked there every day of the week, different classes, variety of classes and stuff. Learned to walk again on a new prosthetic limb, which was really hard work. Obviously, my body had done nothing. And I remember standing up for the first time in 6 months, and I had to sit back down again because my body just couldn't handle it. I was physically shaking. Gently built myself up day after day. They were amazing at the rehab centre. Learned to walk again, first on two crutches, then on one crutch, and then... eventually when I got home, I learned to walk on no crutches. But yeah, when I was in the rehab centre, my dad come and visited me a couple of times, and he didn't moan. Moan's the wrong word, but he just mentioned that he had a pain in his leg, which was unlike him. The old man never moaned about things like that. He was always quiet, you know what I mean, brass about things and just got on with it. But he kept moaning that he had a little pain in his leg, and we at the time when we were in the rehab, he was just saying what I think he drives for a living, as you know, Keith, my dad, he's a chauffeur, and he just thought it was a chauffeur's, like a driving injury. He just thought it was where he was on and off the clutch all the time, or you know what I mean, moving his feet around, and he didn't think nothing of it. And it was only really when I got home in October, and we had about a month and a half, and he kept complaining about it, and it was only around Christmas time that we sort of said to him, look, if that's really giving you jip, you need to go and get that checked out. And he said, yeah, I will after Christmas. And I think he had an appointment on the 27th or something like that, day after Boxing Day. He went up to the hospital and got it checked out. And at first they said to him that it was a deep vein thrombosis was what they said it was, DVP and DVT, sorry. And yeah, obviously they said to him to come back in the new year. They give him some painkillers and off he went. My dad being my dad didn't complain about nothing. Then it got to the new year and he was still in a lot of pain with it. And he went back, I think, January again. They'd done more tests on him, said that they'd have the results back in a couple of weeks. That seemed to go on 3 weeks, 4 weeks. And then the results come back and it was, can you come in for an appointment? And I think it was mid-Feb that he went in for an appointment. And they said that we've located it and we've spotted that it is a sarcoma. Cancer on the leg in your thigh area, but the PET scan that we've done has also shown up spots on your liver and lung, and it was then that they told him that he'd have 18 to 20 months to live. So he goes from this pain in his leg 1 minute, no concern about it, to being told that he had 18 to 20 months to live at his next appointment, which obviously...
How long was that since you come home, Joe?
I come home in October, and he was dealt that news in February. So 3 or 4 months, yeah.
Unreal. So what are you thinking as a family? Obviously, with yourself, and again, you know, what was there times that you felt bitter and angry and?
Yeah. I mean, obviously, I couldn't work out what was going on. I don't know why. We still don't know, and it's just life, isn't it? But I was angry at the fact that it had happened to me. I was angry at the fact that he was now being told this. But we was always positive with him, because the hospital said, you've got 18 to 20 months. That's what you've got. But we're going to give you chemo. And with chemo, you can go on for years. So we took that stance with him all the way up until his first chemo treatment. He was upset, obviously. I've got this long to live. But I said, yeah, but they give you that long, but you've got to look at the positive side of it. If this chemo works, you could go on for years. It might even cure it. You know what I mean? You don't know until you've had the chemo. And yeah, obviously we led up to this chemo appointment. And to be fair, the old man he took it in his stride really at them early stages. And he was quite determined, even though he had his bad days, he was quite determined when he went to that first chemo appointment that he was going to beat it. And we got him there and, for whatever reason, the chemo didn't seem to have any effect on him. And we've actually been told since he passed that the chemo could have made things worse. But that was a chance that he had to take, you know what I mean? And he went to that chemo appointment. And to be honest with you, after that chemo appointment, he was just never the same after that, in terms of his mental state, in terms of the way that he was acting. He was really down, was talking a lot of gibberish. And he went back to another appointment after his chemo a couple of weeks later, and the nurses just took one look at him and said to my mum that we're going to need to take you into a room. They took my mum into a room and they explained to her that the cancer had grown at a rapid rate, and the 18 to 20 months that he was given was now more 2 to 3 months. And that was just heartbreaking. That was just heartbreaking, mate. You just go from your dad, your hero, someone that you've been around every day of your life, to start having this fact in your head that he ain't going to be here in 3 months' time. And I sort of knew in the back of my head that it would be a lot quicker than 3 months. I felt it was going to be a lot quicker than 3 months through the way that he was acting and stuff. And I think me, mum, my sister, deep down knew that he wasn't going to last for those 3 months that they had predicted. But that crushed him. That crushed him. If I'm honest with you, that news probably finished him in terms of his mental well-being. From that point onwards, it was doom and gloom. As you can imagine, I can't imagine anyone being told that news. You know what I mean? Like, how do you deal with that news?
He rung me and told me, and I was like, "What?" And yeah. You know, it's like just Harry, and I don't know. He put it on social media, but you know, just with the cancer, but it was a rare cancer, isn't it?
Yeah, really rare. Rare form of sarcoma. I couldn't tell you the name. It's got too many M's in it and too many I's. But it's a really rare form of cancer that he had, a sarcoma cancer in his thigh that has spread to his liver and lungs. And it was just growing at a rapid rate, so rapid that they couldn't control it. And yeah, it caught up with him in the end.
So they tell you he's got 2 to 3 months. When was this, Joe? This is lockdown time, isn't it?
Yeah, so this was end of March, where they told him this. Straight away, my mum said to me that her words were, in a way, that they killed him that day that they told him. By law, they have to tell you, apparently, that how long you've got left, obviously, so you can prepare yourself and stuff like that. But after that day, he just went downhill rapidly, Keith. Didn't want to talk to anyone, didn't want to associate with anyone, wanted to lay in bed all the time. And there's me and Lauren sort of saying to him, look, come on, let's get out of bed, let's spend some time together, blah, blah, blah. But he just didn't want to do any of it for that initial week. And then what happened was, which was quite sad, really, is that the cancer took over in the end, and he physically couldn't do anything himself. He was bedridden. We had to get him downstairs in a hospital bed, as you know. And obviously we knew that when he got brought downstairs, the day the ambulance come to bring him downstairs, because he couldn't move, they had to bring him out of the bed upstairs and move him to the bed downstairs. And we knew that day that when he got put down here, that he wouldn't be getting out of that bed again. And that was heartbreaking. You know my dad, Keith. He was fit, active. Well, not fit, active. He used to be around, and he used to love socialising with everyone, you know what I mean? And this, especially this time of year with everything that's going on, it was just a shame that in the circumstances that he couldn't get out in those final days and go and see people that he probably would have liked to have seen, you know what I mean? But like I said, in the end, it was just the fact of him being bedridden, unfortunately.
So with in the space when they told you he had 2 to 3 months, how long did that last?
So from the diagnosis at the end of March, He was diagnosed at the end of March. I'm thinking a week, maybe a month and 3 weeks, something along those lines, a month and 3 weeks from the 3 months that he was given. But it was just deterioration every day. It was deterioration every single day of the week. And that's, he was in hospital for probably, out of that month and a half, he was probably in hospital for three weeks of that time, 4 weeks of that time. And the deterioration every day, it went from him being able to text me to not be able to text me, from him being able to watch his films on his iPad to not being able to do that. Then he couldn't lift his phone. And then he was talking deliriously, couldn't make sense of anything he was saying. And then it got to a point where the hospital basically said, look, we've done everything in our power that we can now. It's really now time for him to spend with you now, and he's in the final time that he's got left with you. And mum was quite an advocate of getting him home, as was I. Thought that'd be good for him. But initially, it was really hard work, Keith. It was really hard work. It was horrible to see. You know what I mean? You see a bloke that's just deteriorating in front of your eyes, basically, and it's not nice for anyone. He didn't like to be waited on. He didn't like people doing anything for him. He was quite an independent bloke, and yeah, in the final stages, he fell apart, which was just, it was horrible to watch, you know what I mean? And we had to see that every day. In the end, I took myself out of the situation, and I used to spend a little bit of time by myself. I went and see him, obviously, of course I did, and sat with him and stuff, but it was just too hard for me to sit there every hour of every day with him, because there were days that he were good, that he could talk, and then there were days that he wouldn't know who I was, and that was a shame, and that was horrible to see.
How are you mentally, though, Joe, with that? Because, you know, with all that, you know, what's going on, and we're talking weeks, you're still recovering yourself.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, it's an hard one. You sort of put yourself into a mindset where, what I did anyway, I put myself into a mindset that, look, like, you've got your own things going on. You need to deal with what you've got going on. And obviously, what happened, with the greatest respect, and I don't mean this horrible, but you've just got to be there for dad and be there for the family, but you've still got to worry about yourself, because it's mad. If I forget to take a tablet or something, Keith, that could be me back in hospital. You know what?
You're not out of the woods, are you?
No, by a long shot. I've still got a long way to go. Good few years, probably. But I needed to make sure that at the same time as looking after myself, that I was there for Lauren, that I was there for my mum, and obviously my dad as well in his final stages. Like you said, Keith, we were really close. And every time I walked into the room in the bed, his face lit up, you know what I mean? And I won't forget all of them sort of things. But yeah, mentally, I don't know how. I don't know whether it's something in me. I don't know where I've got it from. I really don't. But I mentally cope with it, and I was able to get on with it, and I was able to talk like I am today. I didn't think I would. I didn't think I would be able to do anything like this, but somehow someone's given me the strength from somewhere to talk about things, and yeah, I feel
like it would be the same.
Yeah, it would be. Yeah, 100%. So yeah, I mean, that's where I'm at the moment. I'm still recovering, of course. This has obviously had a big effect on me mentally, but. Yeah, he's going to be weird and getting to adjust into him not being around. Of course, it is. But he wouldn't want me. He wouldn't want me to be wallowing in it, Keith. He wouldn't want me to be sitting there feeling sorry for myself. He'd say, "Get on with your life, boy." That was his motto. You know what I mean? So that's what I intend to do.
Listen, mate, your strength is unreal, and your mum's strength is even more. So I want to finish. I can't say I'm going to finish on a positive, right? Yeah. But let's talk about your dad. Let's tell everyone how great he was, what his passion was.
Yeah.
So there's going to be people out there going, "Fuck it, he was a, you know, he wound me up." But, you know, that was Martin, and that's why people loved him. We've spoke about your career. Let's talk about your dad, because, you know, I'm the VCD manager now.
Yeah.
Your dad is and was Mr. VCD.
Yeah.
Don't care what anyone says, and anyone know that he took a club from not Sunday morning football, but the ground itself to where it was. You know, he spent every minute. You as a family, let's talk about the pluses and the great times that your dad did.
Oh, he had so many. He joined VCD back in 1993-94 season, I believe. They were a Kent County club. Not sure if
he had a good football career as well, didn't he?
Yeah, really good career. Really good career. He played as a youngster at Cholton. Broke his leg twice, so he was unlucky not to make it. A lot of people tell. Obviously, I never saw him play, but a lot of people tell me he was a very good player. And in different circumstances, he might well have made it, which is nice to hear. You know what I mean? He's had comparisons to some great players, and obviously grew up with Tommy Warrilow and Dave Soul and people like that who all played with him. And he was at Maidstone. He was in the side that got promoted to the league, and then obviously. He went down the managerial route after he stopped playing. Joined VCD in 1993-94. Like I said, I think they were in the Kent County Division 1 or Premier, one of the two. I'm not 100% sure. But took VCD to a different level, to be honest with you, from what they were at. Everyone I talked to, all of his old players, just said that he was so professional in what he'd done with everything in terms of the layout of the dressing room. That completely changed. A lot of the players said it used to be you put the kit bag in the middle of the floor, everyone took their stuff out. And from that, he started hanging up shirts and putting programs on people's pegs. And he set the way, really, down there. And I always say what he'd done, Keith, was he set the pathway for that club to go on to what they've sort of achieved. I think he took it as far as he could take it in terms of his managerial thing in the end. And as we all know, it weren't a nice last year at the club, but it was one of them things. And he left, and I think he could leave with his head held high after everything that he achieved there. You know what I mean? So I think he won the Kent County Premier League, won the treble the first year he was there. I think they didn't win the league though that year. And then the second year they won the double and went up into the Kent from the Kent County League into the then Kent League. I think it was the Brewers Kent League or something back then, mate.
That it was, mate. Yeah, Bombers. Bombers and Brewers. Yeah, it was.
And he went back into that, and yeah, I think he just steadily started building sides that were competitive, mate. As you know, he didn't have a wage budget in his early years there. I think it weren't until the last 2-3 years he was there he had a little bit of a wage budget. But yeah, just sort of built the club up. I remember being down there, Keith, when they were building the ground. I know it seems mad putting the surrounds around the original pitch that was there before it got turned around. I remember the pavilion was there, but it was mainly a cricket pavilion with two massive open changing rooms. And I remember my granddad then, my dad, other people like that, all spending days down there working on this pavilion, putting up like probably the walls that still stand, just about stand today. I know it's all getting done up now, but yeah. And I remember being down there painting it. I remember painting the pavilion myself as a 5-6-year-old kid. You know what I mean? So yeah, there's a lot of history down at VCD, mate. I grew up there, and this. Every time I look back on it, I always look back with smiles. I forget about that last year he was there. What happened, and ultimately, yeah, that what went on, and that'll be something that I'll talk about at a later date. But he's missed the VCD, like you said, mate. And yeah, I think it all.
Sort your of whole family lived there, Joe, didn't they? Your mum, basically, you were there every day.
24/7. I remember getting home from school, and my mum would be like, "Do you want to go down to VCD? That's where Dad is." Yeah, no problem. Drop me down there. I was there for the evening, getting home at 11, 12 o'clock as well. Getting up for next school the next day with matchsticks in my eyes. That was my life. You know what I mean? And I played in all the youth teams up there, as you know, Keith. Played in all the youth teams up there under him, from under 7 to under 16, until I come and joined you. And There's too many good times up there that I can talk about. There's just so many, you know what I mean? I remember, you remember it, Keith, the bar was packed every weekend, wasn't it? You know what I mean? He just got the club buzzing on all fronts, you know what I mean? And the Vars run that we had when we went to Camel Laird, that was amazing. I think I was 15 at the time, 14, 15.
Everton's grand, didn't they?
Yeah, he made some phone calls like he did. The old man got himself busy, rung someone at Everton and spoke to a kit man, I think, there. And then the next thing you know, we're all training at Everton's training ground the night before the game. You know what I mean? Being treated like royalty there. It was unbelievable. It's like they rolled the red carpet out for the team. And we went and done a tour of the ground. And then we went to Liverpool's ground and we done a tour there. And to be fair, they should have beat Camel Laird that day. They had a goal disallowed in the last minute. Gretz got a goal disallowed in the last minute. It was never offside. And if he had equalised, I think they would have gone on to win the game because they were looking the stronger team. But Camel Laird were a force. They were a real force that year, and they were a good side. But yeah, I'll never forget that. We got the England coach up there as well. It's all just happy memories, mate. That's all I keep looking back to be honest with you. Every time I think of him, I smile. You know what I mean? All the memories down there. Even with yourself, Keith. I remember being down there so young, watching your youth team play on the side pitch. You know what I mean? And Nick Davis, Lee Loveridge, all those sort of players coming through. And I don't forget it, mate. I remember everything up there. You know what I mean? So, yes, it's. I can look back on that place with happy memories, mate.
Joe, I've got to read out some of these messages, because some of these messages that are I'll be honest with you, mate. I've not said much because I've let Keith, you know, have it, because he knows you well and knows the story. Yeah. But for me, mate, absolutely incredible you coming on tonight and actually talking about it, and an absolute inspiration, mate. I'll be honest with you. But I mean, I'll read some of these out. Some of the names you may well know. And some you might not, but Kevin Watson's come through and said, absolutely inspirational, Joe. Chris Ottaway, the chairman at Harlow Town, has said, what mental strength you have, Joe. Keith's mum's just giving you a love up. Peter Bauer has come on and said, totally got my respect. Very brave coming on and talking so open and honest. Tom Smith said, well done, Joe. You're a true fighter, mate, and an inspiration. Martin Hill has said, amazing interview. Robert Smith said, great interview, Joe. Dad would be proud. Mark Weaver said he should be so proud. And one that's just come in, John Mann, I see your...
Mate, you should know who Mane is, Dave. Bloody hell.
I see you, your hat-trick, Joe.
Yeah, he did. Probably one of the rare ones where I scored, yeah.
But, I mean, the story, Joe, I mean, for you to come on and actually talk about it, and, you know, and I know, you know, with your dad as well, it's still very raw and saying he's just incredible, mate. I mean, you've spoken tonight. I mean, I've just sat here as a viewer, as anybody else, and just sitting there listening to you, and it's... just absolutely inspirational, my friend.
Funny story about Kevin Watson, actually. Obviously, a couple of days after I fell ill, Cray Valley actually, a couple of days after I woke up, Cray Valley won the league.
Yeah, I remember this.
And he'll get the ump, me keep saying it, but he was at his party, obviously celebrating that they had won the league, and obviously he heard the news that I'd fallen ill. And he drove. He left his his party that he was at where they were celebrating winning the league. He left early and he went and met my dad and give him his league winner's medal to pass on to me in hospital. I just thought that was such a touch of class from Kev. You know what I mean? There was no need for him to do that. You know what I mean at all. But I thought that says a lot about the man. You know what I mean? And we've been in touch ever since. And yeah, I'm really grateful that he done that. That's something that I'll never ever forget. You know what I mean? Just to leave obviously a scene like that where you're obviously rejuvenating over what you've just done. You know what I mean? But to leave that and come and care for me the way he did, I think it says a lot about the man. So yeah, I won't ever forget that. So cheers, Kevin.
Gary Andrews has just come in. It's still flying in now, Joe. I mean, I've never seen anything quite like this since we've been doing the show. But Gary Andrews has come in and said, good to see you today, Joe. Stay true to yourself and the family, mate. Lee Thomas has said, an inspiration to everyone you know, Joe. And Adam Marsh has said, legend 40.
Marshy. Yeah, no, Gary Andrews popped round today telling me the story about how he lifted the Kent County League title, oh, Keith.
Pictures of it, Joe. We keep telling him he didn't really play too much in the Kent League, though. But he's going to maybe come back and say, I'm going to get the sack and all that as he keeps going on. But lovely man, Gal. And is it a lot of people are, Joe, as you know, obviously me included. But the support, just say a little bit. I know you want to and you have, but the support that have you been shocked? Not just with yourself, but also with your dad.
Initially with me, I was gobsmacked at the support that I got. I've got to be honest with you. I was totally gobsmacked with it. And then even more so with my old man. Absolutely. It's been unbelievable, Keith. Like when I say that my phone hasn't stopped, and people say that as a phrase, I mean, my phone has not stopped. Like literally it is beeping like 24/7 through the day, through the night. People sending flowers, people popping around the house and making sure we're all right. It's all been so overwhelming. It really has. You know what I mean? I think I left my phone on charge for an hour the other day and come back to 758 Twitter notifications on my phone, just through people that were tweeting him. You know what I mean? That was just after an hour. And yeah, it's just been incredible, mate. And I honestly can't thank anybody enough. Like I said to you before, it'd be unfair of me to name any individuals, Keith, because even the little messages help get you through, you know what I mean? And when I have my down moments, I look down their messages and see just how many people's lives that he's touched, you know what I mean? And that obviously makes you proud, you know what I mean? A proud son to look at all of that. And yeah, it's been really emotional looking through them. I won't lie to you, but I think that it's been a big coping mechanism for me, getting back to people, saying thank you. And even when I was going through my recovery, thanking people. And yeah, and it also gives you a little bit of a point to prove to people, especially in my recovery. I wanted to prove to people that I could get back out there, mate, you know what I mean, and be normal again. So, yeah, I mean, the messages of support from everyone have just been completely overwhelming. And I just can't thank anyone enough, really.
And obviously, the two other people in your household that's gone through this, obviously, you know, with yourself and obviously your dad, and obviously with your mum going back, you know, even when your dad was a manager, and most women have to put up with a load of shit that gets huge all of us. How has that woman come through, Joe? Obviously, I come and see you yesterday and with her, and, you know, it's your mum. And I know everyone's going to say, you know, and I will do, how proud you are of your dad, but your mum is just saying Kelsey, isn't she?
Yeah, mate.
Honestly, in the Premier League if she was the manager, wouldn't she?
Yeah, she would be, mate. Honestly, yes. And she'd win the European Cup as well. She's been unbelievable, mate. Like, I don't know the strength. I don't know how strong she's been. It's been incredible the way that she's dealt with everything. You know what I mean? Blow after blow after blow, and to still keep getting back up and fighting. But not only being there for me, being there for my dad. I mean, it couldn't have been nice for her to see her husband falling the way he fell away, Keith. You know what I mean? And everything about him, just obviously, and my mum, they've been together since they were at junior school, as you know what I mean. So it's a long time, and I think they would have been married for 34 years this year on their anniversary. So it's a long, long time, you know what I mean, mate. But I don't know. I honestly can't tell you how she's done it, Keith. I'd ask her tomorrow. I ask her all the time. Like I said, how are you so strong? You know what I mean. And I think she lost her dad at a young age, and I think that she's just been mentally tough since then. You know what I mean. And Yeah, she's been a rock, mate. Honestly, she's been a rock for all of us. Like when we're having down days, she gets us back up again. And when she's having a down day, we get her back up again. You know what I mean? We're just working together, mate, really, to just try and get through it, get through this horrible time. And I know it ain't going to get, obviously, time's a healer. It ain't going to get any easier waking up to an empty house without Dad every day. But ultimately, all we can do is just keep remembering all the good times. Like I said, that's all we keep doing. Looking back at photos of the tournaments and stuff that we used to do, and getting drunk with you in the bar, Keith, and things like that. You know what it's like, mate. All that sort of stuff. Yeah, exactly that. So yeah,
and that's the major part, Joe, isn't it, that you've got all them memories, because your dad did do a hell of a lot, and you as a family did, obviously, at the club, and what you've done, and like I said, and I can only say, and I can echo what everyone's saying, that and I know your dad's watching this. He's most probably the proudest person in the world. I know what he thought about. I know what he thought about Lauren as well, and you were his world. And I would say that he is just sitting wherever he is, letting the old players have it still.
Definitely giving
Foley a rollicking up there at the moment.
Yeah.
Having a beer, sitting on a stool, and he will be the proudest man, and he'll be going, "That's my boy."
Yeah, nice.
It's been unbelievable, mate. And like I said, you thanks for coming on.
My pleasure.
But it just shows what sort of family you are, I think. And I think, you know, your dad and your mum's brought you up unbelievable, both of you.
And Joe, we'll cut some of the show away and just have your interview. We'll put that out there at some point tomorrow as well, if that's okay with you. We'll put this in out solely on its own as well for you as well. Because I just echo everything that Keith said, because literally took the words out of my mouth about your dad being proud of you. Wow. I've just sat here for the last hour listening to you, mate, and to be honest with you, mate, I just feel so inspired by you. It's just incredible. So I really do appreciate you coming on tonight, and I wish you and your family all the best for the future. I really do.
I really appreciate that, boys, and keep obviously doing the show as well. I watch it most weeks, and it's blinding, so keep doing what you're doing.
And anytime you want to come on, Joe, you just give Keith a shout, and we'll get you on.
No problem at all. Cheers, mate. Boys. Thanks for everything.
Thanks, Joe. Thanks,
Joe, good luck, mate. Take care, mate.
Thanks, best, mate. Boys. See you, mate. Bye.
There you go, mate.
Well, I think, what do you say after that? I mean, wow. I mean, if people at home haven't enjoyed that last hour, well, then there's something seriously wrong with people, I think, because that was incredible. I mean, I was just sitting here at some point, you know, we're looking at the clock and thinking, wow, you know, and then next minute, you're just so engrossed with everything that Joe was saying, spoke so, you know, incredibly. I mean, it just, you know, and to hear the story of, you know, of how he almost died twice, et cetera, et cetera. And it was just absolutely mind-blowing, Keith. I mean, I know you're closer to the family, you know, you're very close to the family as such, but that was just incredible.
Well, I was still getting emotional. David, I said, the one thing I've noticed over the last, well, even when Joe was ill, is just how strong they've been. And the, you know, the bad, the whole story, he could have kept going till 10 o'clock, you know. Over the few years, like I said, you know, Martin lost his mum, which is obviously, you know, Joe's grandma. Then, you know, Martin's brother died, and, you know, only a few days before Martin passed, that they had to put their dog down as well. That had been, you know, it's unbelievable. And to get a young lad that, to be fair, that had a tough upbringing, not with the family, because obviously it was cast of, you know, oh, you're Martin's boy, and had to sort of get his way through coaching into football management on his own merit, not because of his dad, his own merit, which was hard, especially around this neck of the woods, because Martin is obviously really well known, and how he was, and strong minded, and to be the person he is now, even not with what he went through. Wow, if I've got 10% of what they've got, then I would be happy. I'm like I said, I'm inspired by him and whatever, and you know.
Yeah.
Unreal. And like I said, there's so many people that they are going to want to thank, and they will do. And obviously there's things planned, obviously, in the future to recognise Martin, Joe and the Fools. But wow, if you are an up and coming chairman or a chairman that's looking for someone, Joe's worth definitely to talk to, because if he's got the passion and that his mum's got, and his dad had unbelievably, and with the right guidance, we'll carry the legacy on.
Absolutely. Well, just a couple of messages before we finish. Danny Martin said, lovely interview. Thanks for talking about it, Joe. So proud. Kevin Watson, and what a superstar he is with that story, giving him his thing. Incredible.
Kevin's
well done for getting him on, Keith. And then Gary Andrews has said, give him the VCD job.
All day long, he could have it. If he wanted it, I'd let him have it. Don't worry about that. Be a better person than me. Perfectly treated. One thing Joe forgot to say as well, I think Kevin actually took the Lee Trophy in as well.
Wow.
So I remember the pictures, and just it's just what football does, but that will just give you an idea of what they were like. And like I said, people, you can say Marmite with everybody. You know, Martin was very strong charactered, and he learned me a hell of a lot. What Joe said about the professionalism was right. The way my kit's all set out, wait till you tell you, everything, all that people tell, all come from Martin. You know, he took non-league football at the time at the level to a completely different level.
Mm. Well, the 2 hours, as you can imagine, has gone way past. We're way past it. But all I would say is, Keith, I mean, how do we top that next week? Well, no idea. But, I mean, if there's anybody out there that's got anybody that wants to come on the show and have a chat with us, exactly the same as Joe's done, I mean, we're more than happy to have anybody to come on the show and have a chat with us as well. And so, please, you know, if there's anybody out there that wants to come on and tell your story, why not come on and do this, you know, be as brave and as inspirational as Joe was tonight, and we'd be more than a pleasure for you to come on and have a chat with me and Keith this time next week. But hopefully everybody out there has enjoyed the show as much as I have tonight, and I think as Keith has as well. Listen, me and Keith will be back next week, but until then, keep yourself safe, keep your family safe, and we'll see you again 7 o'clock next Monday night. Good night.